Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Welcome to an Axe of the Blood God special interview with the developers at Red Hook Studios. We are going to be talking about Darkest Dungeon and Darkest Dungeon 2 a little bit at least, and we are going through the kind of the history of its development, various aspects of its development in order to get them to defend turn-based combat. I had originally intended this to be part of a normal episode of Axe of the Blood God, specifically the one that just went up with Suikoden 2, but it ended up being pretty long, and I didn't really want to cut it back too much, and I also didn't want the episode to be like 2.5 hours long, even though I know some people like that kind of thing. So I thought that I would split it out for all of you Darkest Dungeon fans out there. And if you're not familiar with Darkest Dungeon, that's all right, because I kind of explain it and everything, and we talk about some of the basic concepts and everything. And if you haven't tried it, I really encourage you to do so. But okay, so we are going to move on, and we're going to talk to Chris and Tyler about Darkest Dungeon, what went right, what went wrong, the Switch port, the combat, and everything else. Let's get going. Okay, joining me now is Chris Barassa and Tyler Sigmund from Red Hook Studios. They are developers on Darkest Dungeon. Tyler's been on the show before. He was here back when Darkest Dungeon first came out. A lot of water has passed under the bridge. A lot of heroes have died horrible, horrible, horrible deaths down in the Darkest Dungeons below. The Blood God loves the Darkest Dungeon. I was a huge fan of Darkest Dungeon when it came out. I've played multiple games since then, and I guess the question that I kind of want to start out with, now that you've announced Darkest Dungeon 2 and you're moving on to your new project, is how did Darkest Dungeon 1 kind of change you guys?
Well, let's start with the professional. I mean, I think it was just a great experience to literally start from Chris and I in a room with a bunch of dreams, and then we were already developers in the industry, but and had kind of, made some of our own projects before at various places. And, but Chris and I, had wanted to do something together for a long time. And so it's pretty cool to see that whole, now there's an arc to it. For a long time, it was just the, oh my God, we got to make this game and make it, and try to make sure that we don't lose the ability to pay rent and things like this in the meantime. And now we've got the whole story of we set out to do something. We really had faith in the idea that we did it, and then it ended up working. And so you have to transition out of that, like, oh my God, how do we start this up process, now to the, okay, the ship is running and going full speed. Now we got to steer it.
How much has Red Hook Studios grown since the original Darkest Dungeon came out?
Quite a lot. We started with, like Tyler said, just the two of us. And then I think we had about 5 core people, not counting our composer and narrator and audio partners. But not counting those guys, it was about 5 internal that launched the first game. And now we have, I think, close to 14, if I'm not mistaken. Mostly in Vancouver, some are distributed. And we're probably going to add a couple of more as we kind of go through the next phases of production. So it's a pretty significant shift, and we've been trying to go slow because, we don't want to just throw a bunch of people who don't know each other into the mix. I think part of the reason why the first game worked, and certainly why the experience was, I think profoundly positive for me, was just we get to work with people that we knew, had always wanted to work with, knew they would be reliable in a pinch, and we got to grow relationships with people that we, already had a significant amount of of trust and confidence in. So I think it's important for us, like as we move forward, to keep that in mind and you know, build a team out of people that are like-minded and that kind of thing.
So anybody who isn't familiar with Darkest Dungeon, the basic premise is that heroes, well, I put heroes in air quotes, they're kind of the scum of the scum, darkest scum, I suppose. You have your jesters and your highwaymen and your grave robbers and plague doctors are all coming through, and you're putting them into parties and sending them into what effectively is hell, even to the point that there's Lovecraftian beasts who will appear when it's dark in the darkest dungeon. And your goal is to just keep leveling them up, leveling them up, leveling them up to the point where you can actually invade the darkest dungeon. It's a turn-based game. There are a lot of really interesting party combos. There's a large survival element to it where you are trying to stay alive as long as possible. And of course, there's a narrator who is telling you about how everything could go wrong horribly at any possible moment. It really stood out to me because of its outstanding artwork, for one thing. The narrator, of course, the sound design, the creature design, which was just gross. Also just the really interesting depth of putting together all of the different parties and everything. And I'm curious, like, how has your kind of understanding of the format of Darkest Dungeon evolved over time? Because it's been, you know, 4 years, multiple expansions.
It's cool to see, like, people, like, one thing we always wanted from the get-go that I think people latched onto was just the variety of party comps and how you could kind of swap guys in and out, and that would open up different opportunities, not just mechanically, but you know, a little thematically as well. So it's cool to see that really land. But we were really surprised. I'm teeing Tyler up to talk about this, but we were really surprised that, like, the whole linchpin of the game, this idea that, like, flawed heroes can get overwhelmed with stress and then behave unpredictably. We called it the affliction system. We were shocked that we hardly had to touch that during early access, and that it did enough of what it set out to do that most of players' concerns and where we spent most of our development time was really on balance, tuning, and more content, and not really on this, like, tentpole system, you know, that we were sort of crossing our fingers would land for people. It was pretty surprising to me that we didn't have to sort of constantly revisit that in light of player feedback, and really most of our efforts were focused elsewhere, despite the proposition of the game being, like, you know, held up by this affliction system.
Yeah, I could see it being extremely tricky to balance, because not only do you have to worry about the fact that once a character becomes afflicted, they have the potential to do a huge amount of damage to your party just by virtue of the fact that they might be cutting themselves or moving around in line or refusing to move or whatever. Like, getting afflicted is the worst.
Yeah, and it's fun to play with agency that way.
Yeah, like, missing a turn has a, you know, it's all a matter of kind of when it happens. You know, if you're in a trivial fight and you're doing pretty well and it just, you know, that character happens to be afflicted and they miss a turn, you're kind of like, eh, no big deal. But if it happens, you know, at the worst possible time, you know, when you're facing a boss or something. And I think that texture, that sort of, I guess, mechanical and probabilistic texture leads to a lot of narrative texture in terms of you creating your own tale with these heroes. And I think that some of these things were like the understanding of the game, I guess, like, where I'm going with this point is kind of cool that it's been now, what, a little over 5 years since we started development on Darkest Dungeon. Is that right? We started in 2013.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, and so certain ideas up front were always there, like what we wanted to do with the affliction system, you know, all that have been really sort of like continuous through the whole process. But how we did it, you know, took some time to figure out. And as to your question of kind of the understanding, I think a really neat thing is the way we built the game and the way it happened and being able to go through early access and things like that has allowed us to basically grow and get more and more familiar with our own game as it went. So certain ideas, you know, never really evolved, and that's a good thing in terms of our goal, what we wanted to do. But, you know, we we understand the game a lot better now. That's, you know, one reason we're excited to work on a sequel is we just felt there's more we want to do. You know, I think it's such a rare opportunity in games to be able to kind of like double down on what you've already built. I mean, it's a lot of times you're changing technology and games you're doing a totally different game every project. And we were really excited to do more because we feel like, you know, we just now got our whole like palette of colors and learned how to paint. And sorry for the artistic analogy, because I'm not an artist, so Chris is probably cringing. But, you know, it's like you finally get set up and now it's time to like continue building on that instead of being like, okay, let's tear it all down and, you know, start from scratch. We're not having to start from scratch.
It was interesting too, because like a lot of the ideas, you know, we talked about a couple of different ways of moving forward into a second game, but they were all the serious discussions were around something to do with Darkest Dungeon, not from any other standpoint than really we just have a lot of enthusiasm for it and feel strongly that there's a lot more we can do with it.
One of the things with Darkest Dungeon that it happened to me, I know that it happened to a fair number of people, is that the way that the game is structured is such that you go through the initial run of dungeons, you fight a whole bunch of bosses that become familiar to you, and then you move up to the next level, the more intermediate level, you fight those bosses again, then the advanced level, fight those bosses again, and then finally you get to the Darkest Dungeon. And I know a lot of people kind of have run out of steam a little bit fighting the same run of bosses again in the second tier. And I'm wondering if this is something that you also observed and if it's affected your kind of approach to Darkest Dungeon 2.
Actually, in Darkest Dungeon 2, there's only one boss and you only fight him again and again and again for 85 hours.
Yeah, we realized that 12 bosses or whatever was just dividing your focus too much.
we saw that. I think that actually speaks to a bigger point about like the game being very long and people finding a bit of fatigue as they move through it. And I think certainly that's a fair critique of the first game, despite the fact that, you know, we've done a whole bunch of patching around to try to mitigate that. I think it goes back to our early access structure where we wanted to hold the end game back so that like our 1.0 launch day was like a big deal, even if you've been playing the game for a little while, because we didn't add the final Darkest Dungeon until our full year in early access was complete. And the consequence of that choice was that we had no clear metrics on a large scale of how long it actually takes to beat the game or how long people typically spend in the mid game, for example. And because we were, you know, we didn't have an end-to-end timeline set up. So but we're definitely cognizant of that, you know, moving forward. And we've talked about it a lot internally. And I think, like, although we are doing more Darkest Dungeon, we are doing a sequel, we're certainly not, it's not the same game again. We're changing a lot. And we're very mindful of kind of where the first game fell short.
No, that's fine. I didn't mean to stomp on you. Yeah, I think goal-wise, for example, it was never like a intention or pillar for us, you know, to be like, we want to make it a 100-hour game to complete. That was never something we set out to do. It was more of a byproduct of just, you know, focusing on all the systems and trying to make an interesting play experience and make sure that, you know, like it was far more important to us that your decisions matter. You know, it ended up kind of being, you know, honestly longer than we would like, because we want you to see all the content. We, you know, it's sad for us when people don't get to see the Darkest Dungeon or, you know, things like that. And that led to the creation of the Radiant Mode patch, which tries to dramatically reduce mid and late game grind. But even that, you know, there was limited, it's impossible to remove. What am I trying to say? There's like limited amounts to do within the infrastructure that was already set up. And, you know, we love that metagame loop. I think it's been very successful, you know, in terms of just the way the metagame's structured. But yeah, it wasn't really like a goal to make a long game for long game's sake. And I think those learnings are definitely something we're taking into the second one, because we, you know, just by way of analogy, like I would love for everyone who have played Darkest Dungeon to be able to see the Darkest Dungeon and see all the content and get the story, you know, get the story and the wrap up and all that kind of stuff, and then play again. Cause you know, the game is replayable. It's not really like, you're not playing it only for the story. So once you've seen it all, it doesn't really spoil, the experience. You know, we don't want to make it like you have to be in the top 5% to see that whole experience. So, we are definitely looking at what are the top reasons that people bounce off Darkest Dungeon, and, you know, how can we, I don't want to say like it's our goal to reach everyone, because it's never been our goal to reach everyone. We want to service the people that love it, but if there's ways we can like sand off some of the edges that bounce people off, that might be good.
Yeah, or just not make the same mistake twice. Like if there's fresh critiques of Darkest Dungeon 2, which I'm sure there will be, it would be nice if one of them isn't, wow, these guys made another super long, super middle heavy experience. You know, I would just love to be critiqued for something different the second time out.
Yeah. But what we, in case those, you know, listening are panicking, what we don't want to compromise is your decisions are crucial and matter. They have consequences. It can be hard. You know, we have no interest in making a game that's not difficult in some way, but we want, you know, the goal is for it to be rewarding, and for you to feel that even when you fail, it was time well spent, you know. And I think those are important to us.
With your expansions, so you played around with the form a little bit. The first expansion had you going through this enormous maze, like truly enormous maze, and it had the ability to get your heroes infected with the blood plague and everything. And then with Color of Madness, which came out I think last year, you added a different way. It was almost kind of like waves, fighting waves of enemies and trying to last as long as possible. If I'm correct me if I'm wrong, I never got around to playing Color of Madness, my apologies. So I'm curious, like, what did you learn from those expansions, and like, did you see things in them that you liked and kind of want to carry over into the sequel?
Well, I think we just tried to do something different each time we came out with something. So like, you know, we really wanted to try these exhaustive long dungeons where, you know, you can come back and your progress is saved. And we wanted to sort of wrap the coils of the Crimson Court expansion like into the main game. We thought it would be exciting and interesting to really shake up the meta gameplay, not just the monsters that you're fighting. And then as a counter to that, when we did Color of Madness, we wanted something that was more of a combat sandbox and really allowed both players who are learning and also advanced players to tinker and experiment with different comps and builds and loadouts in a relatively permissive environment. Because even if you lose your guys in Color of Madness, even if they die in a fight, they only get out of commission for a week, unlike the rest of the game where they're permanently dead. And that was just because we wanted to incentivize people to actually try different things in that mode. So I think our philosophy is always like, we don't want to just do the same thing again and again. It would have been very easy to just make another dungeon, throw in 5 or 6 enemies and put that up for sale. But for us, we want to make sure that we're pushing ourselves as developers, you know, and that same philosophy is carrying forward into the second game. We could opt to recreate the first game with some new content and some fresh presentation, but we're really trying to push things a lot further mechanically and creatively.
Yeah, we even learned, you know, learning on the job sounds silly, but, you know, we learned from our own sort of experimentations. And like Chris is saying, we want to do different things and we're not afraid to try things that maybe don't end up, I don't know, like they have their flaws, just like the heroes, you know. Like, so I think Crimson Court is like oozing with substance, and there's so much packed in there, and it can ratchet up the difficulty of the game because of the Crimson Curse. And I mean, the bosses are really interesting and involved, and the like you mentioned, the quests and the dungeons, the mazes, you know, we sort of blew it out. And I mean, honestly, I think there's like an enormous amount of content packed in there, and we sold it for $9.99. But one of the downsides is, you know, which we didn't really think about, was for all new players that are coming, you know, and then maybe they buy the bundle right off the bat, And they're like, oh yeah, I'm going to enable Crimson Court because I just bought this awesome.
Why wouldn't I? It's new content, right?
Yeah, and it's really not a good first playthrough experience. So when we did, you know, I know like when we made Color Madness, it was definitely talked about that we're like, we want to add cool stuff, but not make you feel like, oh, this is ruining your ability to play the game normally. So for example, when you have Color Madness enabled, you can just kind of, you could engage with it or not. And it's really just all, I don't know.
It's more opt-in.
Yeah, it's opt-in. So you can, you know, it's cool. And we definitely would encourage, you know, any new purchasers, go ahead and enable it. It's not going to hurt you. It's there when you want to dabble in it. But, you know, if you start with Crimson Court enabled, then, you know, it'll reach out its tendrils and get you. But Crimson Court in a lot of ways represents what Dark's Dungeon is. It's like, you know, it's sort of out of your control to make all this work. But Dark's Dungeon is already that way anyway, and so it can be a little bit like too much for like a new player. So, you know, that's a good example maybe of how, you know, we learn from some of the things that bounce people off, of how we take some of those learnings maybe in a second. But I don't want to sound like I'm slogging on Crimson Court, because I think it's an amazing, like, honestly, I just think it's a good piece of work. And I say that because like of all the effort that went into it. And but there's like different ways to kind of attack this problem when you're building on top of a game that is already designed to be kind of harsh and challenging.
So looking back at the actual character classes, there are a lot of really memorable characters in there. I think like the Abomination, which can turn into a monster at the expense of creating a lot of stress for your party, that kind of thing. I'm curious, which character kind of really worked out the best for you, where you're like, yes, this concept ended up being perfect, we're really satisfied with everything? Which one kind of became the most challenging in terms of balance or working on that kind of thing?
It's a good question. It's hard. I love them all so much.
They're all interesting in their own way, aren't they?
I'm glad you're not sick of them, Chris, because, you know, Chris, like, obviously, Chris does the, Chris is the artist as well. I mean, we have additional artists on staff now too, but, you know, Chris does the character designs and, I think it's a good sign that you're not sick of them, because I don't know, you know, sometimes you make something and after you've dealt with it for a couple of years, you're like, I just want to get on to anything new, you know?
I don't feel that way at all. I actually really excited. We're really focusing on the characters a lot going forward, and it'll be really cool to explore them a little bit more. But I think like, I have my favorites, but my favorites aren't the ones that I think are necessarily the best examples of that. Like, I think ultimately the most Darkest Dungeon character, I think, is the leper, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it's the most unconventional class. I think we paid it off with like, it deadens your nerve endings. So he's really tanky, and I think we made him interesting by making him sort of low accuracy, but hits like a freight train when you handle him properly. And then visually, I think his idealized male body chest plate is kind of like a nice, sad, ironic touch to what's probably actually going on under there. And, you know, the broken sword for the broken man kind of thing is a good metaphor. So I think like visually, mechanically, he typifies kind of maybe, or he's one of the best examples of like what we're after with a successful character design that we feel like is really aligned with our IP.
Yeah. He was also like, he was a noticeable moment when we,
it's true.
When we worked on him, where we were like, yes, you know, so I think like, I don't know. He just represented kind of like an affirmation for Chris and I. I just remember the discussion because it was like, you know, yes, we need to be bold like this. Like this is on the right track. This is going to like shock people in a way, right? Just because it's just weird. It's weird and interesting. And then the theme led to great mechanics, you know, like you were saying there, Chris, with combat, but also like camping became interesting because. Yep. You know, it's just like the skills almost wrote themselves, because it's like, oh, you know, he wants to relax. Well, how does he relax? Like letting himself be shown. Well, that freaks everyone else out. You know, and it really to be clear, like, we weren't playing that for humor. It was just trying to like really pay that off of like, you know, here's the, you know, I don't know. They're all kind of wayward characters, which I think are like really paid off well in the comics that the single page origin comics that Chris and Trudy made, and people can find those out on the web now or so they're all wayward characters, but I think the leper was just a great embodiment of like how we need to kind of sidestep, you know, because some of the classes are a lot more direct, you know, a crusader or whatever, which still had its point as like, we didn't want to just do quote fighter. We were like, okay, what makes a crusader weird is, you know, they're like super zealous. But
yeah, they're a religious fanatic.
Yeah, like religious fanatic, but it really, you know, Leopard just kind of was like, yeah, we need to get weird.
Yeah, I think visually too, like the Plague Doctor lands, and I'm glad that we were sort of one of the first waves breaking that shore. Like, mm-hmm. I think they've grown in popularity since. I'm not attributing that to us, just to be clear. I'm just saying, like,
I take credit for it. It's all good.
We managed to get in a little early on the Plague Doctor game, which was good. So I think she works visually, and I really liked that we made her a woman. I grew up playing Metroid, and I always really respected that reversal of expectations. So when I still see Reddit posts of people saying like, you know, the Plague Doctor, you know, he's really cool, and then someone corrects them, I always get a little sort of hit of dopamine there. I like that a lot.
It's also like the Pyro in Team Fortress 2.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it's fun to sort of have that layered in there and then let players kind of come to it and sometimes challenge their own assumptions. But
Identity-wise, Plague Doctor has been really key for a lot of our... It's just really distinctive and recognizable. And so, like, she keeps... I don't know. I'm just thinking of like the polls we've done and a lot of the marketing we've done. Like she's, a really good, like piece of the brand identity, I guess.
This could be the whole podcast, honestly, because we even did like an internal ranking system for all, cause we have like 16 characters now and, you know, they can't all be your favorite. Right. So we did an internal ranking system to try and see, you know, in the bleak future, if we had to cut it down to six or something, you know, which is not, I'm not saying that's what we're doing. That's not what we're doing, but it was really hard. Like the results were very contentious and people were very passionate about like, you know, which characters that they felt absolutely had to be, you know, to remain versus which could get cut. And it was really interesting to see. And I think really affirming because like there was a few overlaps, but generally speaking, the results were pretty widespread, which I think means that, as a cast, they're fulfilling their role of appealing to different people in different ways.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, if you forgive me, I think it's interesting the way that you introduce everybody out with the Highwayman and the Crusader, just to be like, oh yeah, and these are fairly conventional. And then pretty soon, a lot of really unconventional classes start coming in, and there's a real process of going from the fairly accessible, easy to understand, straightforward traditional classes like Crusader, and then into the much more esoteric classes, like definitely Leper is a good example of that.
Abomination too, I think. I mean, and to be clear, we worked with a backer on that character who really wanted a werewolf type character, and you know, the same way we didn't do vampires the regular way, I didn't want to do a werewolf the regular way either. And I think in the end, that character turned out really cool. There's a lot of superhero DNA in our cast of characters. Like, you know, he's Bruce Banner and the Hulk, and you know, we've got sort of a Batman with the bounty hunter, and you know, the leper is, you know, kind of prototypically Iron Man. You know, the weak man inside a suit of metal, and got the kind of same, the mask evokes it. So there's a lot of that sort of X-Men superhero iconography that I tried to work in, at least visually and certainly into their origin stories, which Tyler mentioned during the comics. And I think that really works to help sort of build a timelessness to the cast.
So which character ended up needing the most work ultimately? And when I say most work, I mean from a balance standpoint, mechanical standpoint.
Flagellant, maybe?
That's a good question. Yeah. Well, actually, I think the Jester...
Definitely the Jester.
Yeah, no way, because
it's either too OP or too weak.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
It's either too OP or too weak.
Yeah, and you know, balance is tricky because you want to be like, oh, well, what is the actual purpose? Because like one thing I know I've sort of spoken about a few times on is that we never set out to make the characters evenly balanced. But the point is each character needs to have a role. There needs to be a time when you're like, I really need this character, whether that's a particular dungeon or a boss, or, you know, things like that. So we sort of went in being accepting of the idea that someone might say, oh, you know, I'd rather have a crusader, you know, 90% of the time than a blank. As long as 10% of the time you really need the blank. but over time, you know, that gets like smushed a little bit because I think people, you know, fans' natural inclination is make everything balanced. You know, they're going to want you to make things balanced, even though honestly, I think they don't necessarily always know what they're asking for in terms of what that means. You know, we like there to be spiky bits, but that doesn't mean there isn't imbalance that needs correct, and we definitely struggled with that on a lot of classes, just to be clear. But Jester was tough because you know, the Jester's role above all was stress healing, and he, I think he came out of the gate pretty good like that. People were like, well, this class is kind of weird, I don't know, and then all of a sudden within a week it's like people were running dark runs, you know, with a Jester and never had to worry about stress, and we're like, oh, okay, that's too much. So then, you know, we dial it back, and then people are like, why would I ever take a Jester now?
You know, then we buff him with the building from Crimson Court, and he's one-shotting bosses on the first turn, and we're like, oh my god, we can't do that.
Make sure he's combat, you know, let's make sure his combat's interesting. And
I guess we were the joke in the end.
But he was fun, and I remember, like he went through several, like, kind of full kit revisions. Chris had some great ideas on like really trying to pay out the musical aspect into his moves. And that's where like kind of his surviving kit still has a lot of that in there with like kind of setups and, you know, the finale and all that kind of stuff. And so I think he's pretty interesting because he still, you know, performs that stress healing role, but he's also can be, you know, really interesting in combat. And, but he definitely, you know, I think even today, you know, I think there's probably a bunch of people that are like, he's either too weak or too strong. But, yeah, he's been problematic. I think another, this is more just for the comic aspect, but the whole character wasn't so bad, the bounty hunter, but he's had a few skills that were tough, and the old hook and slice skill just gave me fits for ages. I think it's been through like 4 complete revisions, changes. I don't even know what it is right now. I forget because it's been through so many changes.
Can you confirm whether or not the entire cast is coming back for Dark Ascension 2?
What we can say is that you will see some of your favorite heroes in Dark Ascension 2.
Okay.
We want to play with the same cast. We want to like actually integrate, like the comics are probably seen by like 10% of our audience, and so we want to really integrate their origins and their backstories into the game itself. I would be remiss to promise at this early date that everybody's coming back, so I'm not saying that. But it's this.
But we're not saying they're not.
Yeah, I don't want to be evasive for its own sake, but I don't want to promise something that, you know, ultimately we don't ever get there, or we decide to inject some new blood into the roster. But as it sits right now, our goal is, yeah, absolutely to bring back as many of them as we can, maybe not all on first commercial release. But we also want to kind of like, I always love getting the next Street Fighter game because it's like all your old favorites are there, and then they put, you know, Cody, and he's got just escaped from jail and he can throw sand. You know, it's cool to bring out a new character as well. So I think we want to try to adopt a bit of that mentality. So, I mean, Chun-Li and E-Honda and Guile and all those guys are going to make their way back, but we want to have a few surprises. And, you know, the nature of development is like, if we're going to do something new, then we can't also do the same amount of work on something old. So, you know, it might not all come out all at the same time. We might not get to every single character, but we're definitely playing with the same cast to a greater or lesser degree.
I'm curious, have you given any thought to, for example, having multiple versions of the same character, because all of the characters currently have one variant. They have different colors, but you can't say equip accessories that show on the characters, or have different versions of various characters to kind of mix it up a little bit. Have you given any thought to that aspect of it?
I'm thinking we're still want to be pretty mum on a lot of things. So I don't know. I think
it would be safe to say that we've treated them in the comics as being like a single character. Like the Grave Robber has an origin story, and that is more how we're thinking about things going forward.
I see. So it's not necessarily, here are 20 versions of the same person. Wow, they have a lot of siblings. This is one person and they have a story and we want to tell.
Yeah, I think that's more in line philosophically with where our head's been at. And I'm using those words carefully because, you know, like I said, we have a ways to go in development, and we're trying to keep things pretty close to the chest just right now. But certainly we're thinking more of the characters that way than we are in, like, here's the Man-at-Arms and his 600 Man-at-Arm brothers, you know, that you can just feed into this gaping dungeon mouth.
I'm getting the image of Ned Flanders and all of his brothers. Simpsons. Exactly. Oakley, yeah. Oakley.
It makes me laugh when I see streamers that like label their characters like Crusader 3, Crusader 4.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause you just know, like, oh, they've been through so many that they just don't even want to name them anymore. And, which is kind of, you know, amazing in itself. Like Chum, you know, they're just all Chum.
Yeah, exactly. And that worked really well for the structure of the first game. Yes. And it would have been weird to only have like one of every guy, but then have the metagame work the way it does. So, but again, as we mentioned in that PC Gamer article, we're doing some dramatic changes to the metagame that, you know, we're not really going to comment on specifically, but it's a fundamentally different metagame experience. And as a result, we may not approach the cast the same way. I think it's just, the bottom line is we really want the next game to stand on its own, and it's going to inherit a lot of DNA from its older brother, but it's got to be its own experience. It can't just be a more polished or larger scoped version of the first game. Tyler says it a lot, and I think it's definitely a good pillar to come back to, that we want people to be able to buy both games and get a different experience out of them. So just because you own two doesn't mean you can't go back and get some fresh experiences out of one, and vice versa.
So looking at the original Darkest Dungeon, it started life, obviously, as a PC game, a point-and-click PC game. And then eventually it made its way to multiple platforms, including the Vita, the PS4, Xbox One, Switch, iPad, basically everything. But there have been some comments about how the UI and UX experience was a little rough at points. I'm curious, like, what did you learn from this experience of porting this Darkest Dungeon to all of these different platforms?
Well, okay, I just want to jump out ahead of this. We had no idea that the game would be as successful as it was. So we designed it to be a PC keyboard and mouse game, like, from the ground up. And I think in a lot of cases, designed ourselves into a corner.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, those are, I'm sure we verbatim probably said this, like, we'll deal with that when we get to it. Like,
yeah.
Like, if we need to figure out how to make this work with the controller, like, that's a good problem to have. And then suddenly it becomes...
Suddenly that was the problem we had.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you're like, well, I don't love this problem now that I'm in it. Yeah, I think that, I don't know, we UI is a tough thing. And I think, like, you know, we did a lot of the game with the skeleton crew, you know, and I think this is kind of true across the board, like, because of the success, we're able to make some investments in staff, you know, to try to be able to put the right expertise and horsepower on different things that maybe before we had to split between people that were already doing three other jobs too. You know, I don't know. I mean, this isn't trying to throw any part of one under the bus. It's more like you,
No, these are just development realities. I mean, we didn't know that we would be on so many consoles. So we designed for what we knew. We didn't have a lot of budget. We didn't have a huge team. So we were all sort of chipping in on UI, and UI is a massive, it's an entire discipline with trained specialists. And we didn't, you know, we weren't in a position to leverage any of those. None of this is an excuse. It's just things that happened along the way.
Yeah. So a lot of the porting became, okay, like how can we make this work without having to rewrite an entire screen? You know, like effectively redesign, you know, because we don't want to, let's see, we don't want to design the whole game differently for every platform. You know, so we really were trying to figure out just how to adapt. And in a few cases, you know, I remember, yeah, I mean, I know we probably get more comments on it with Switch than anything else. But at the same time, I think Switch has been incredibly successful, and I think is one of the best play experiences for the game, you know, once you just can get over a little bit of the learning curve with the UI, but it's like such a perfect match for that platform. But you know, Switch didn't even exist, you know, when we started making Dark's Dungeon. We had no idea it was coming, and you know, it's one of those like really happy accidents that when it was announced, we're like, wow, you know, this, I think Dark's Dungeon would be really good on it, you know, like it's a perfect kind of play session based, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I remember some discussions during the Switch porting where we were just like, okay, what buttons are left? Like, what can we, you know, what combination of button presses can we make for this particular command? And, you know, I think given the restrictions, the team did a great job. Like the programmers and, you know, our producer, John, helped with that process, and our excellent QA person, Kyle, and like our programmer Pierre, who was working on the Switch port, like honestly, I think they did an amazing job. It was kind of like, you know, we set up some boundaries that were like, okay, we can't rewrite entire screens. So given that, what can we do? Anything else would have made it take twice as long and, you know, twice as much. And we kind of made that call that it'd be better to get it out and, you know, of course, functional, just maybe not. You know, not, I don't know, you're not going to hold it up and be like, here's an example of, you know, excellent user interface. You know, it's more like, here's an awesome game and it's got a little bit of clunky controls. Okay, we can look at that.
Over the course of Darkest Dungeon's development, there's been a lot of efforts to kind of streamline it, make it more accessible to newcomers, not lower the difficulty, but make it less bruising. For example, when you lose an entire high-level party, it's a little easier to get new characters in the door and keep going. And I'm just wondering, like, what's it like to try and balance the desire to keep Darkest Dungeon a hardcore experience without, you know, having it go completely off the deep end, as it were?
I think, you know, that's like what you mentioned there is kind of like reflective of Radiant Mode again. Oops, that pun wasn't intended, but actually it was, I'm going to say simple philosophically, because we really didn't want to compromise what Dark's Dungeon's about. So, I think, you know, Radiant Mode, there's kind of a good distinction to make there. We wanted to reduce the grind, not reduce the difficulty. And that there are two totally separate things. And, you know, so, and you can play with the cost, you know, the consequences a little bit, but there was no part of us that wanted to, compromise on, you know, being like, hey, like we're not trying to reduce the consequences overall. We're not trying to make this game appeal to everyone. Because we had such a strong sort of like, identity for what we wanted out of the game, we didn't have to really wrestle philosophically with some of those questions that might have turned the game into what we didn't want it to be. Essentially, it was easy just to hold the line. We're like, we'd rather someone doesn't buy it if it's not for them than try to retrofit it and make it for them. But, you know, the things like grind hours, like that goes back to sort of the comment I made earlier where it was never a design pillar. It was never a piece of identity of the game. We never said, you know, we want this to be a long
slog. We set out to make the grindiest game ever.
Yeah. Yeah. It was more like, we want your decisions to matter. We want it to be, you know, shockingly difficult in certain ways. But, you know, when you actually back up, you say, wait, you can't actually lose the game. You just can have setbacks. that, so to answer your question, like in a way it was easy because some of the ideas that would have like neutered the game, we just didn't really ever seriously consider because our goal was not to sell as many copies of the game as we could by, you know, trying to appeal to everyone. We were always trying to be very consistent about, you know, and there's always people that, you know, and I'm sure some of your listeners, someone will think, oh, well, you did sort of, you know, it's not as hardcore as it used to be, or, you know, I don't know. I think there's a lot of different viewpoints on it, but I feel like we held the line pretty well and we never really compromised on what we wanted the game to be. We just played around with the things that were kind of unintentional side effects.
Yeah. I think tonally too, like we get a lot of hardcore just out of subject matter and the fact that there's permanent consequences and the fact that as a player on your first playthrough, you don't have a lot of operational intelligence. We don't give you do a lot of hand holding, like all of that contributes to what we wanted out of the game, which is a sense of foreboding and uncertainty and, keeping players kind of uncomfortable. So I think that that stuff is core to the IP. Doing like 100 missions in the middle of the game, like Tyler said, that's not a central premise that we were really trying to execute on.
Oh yeah, and just one bookend on that is, however, none of the balancing is really easy, but it all comes down from, you know, honestly, like the way to make it easier is just have a strong philosophical and creative identity, you know, because a lot of balance really just comes down to who are you balancing for, what is your intent, and things like that. So it's very, very difficult, but you can make it at least somewhat easier by like outlawing where you don't want to be. You know, we never want to make it a casual game, and we don't use that, you know, term as a, you know, like as an insult, but it's just Darkest Dungeon is not, you know, it's not the kind of game you'd recommend to someone who just wants to dabble. You know, it's not, we'd rather have an identity of what we want it to be.
So two more quick questions. I'm sure that you know that Pokemon was announced a few days ago, and I've seen some comments from people saying that that turn-based combat from Pokemon is outdated and they should try something else, that the gameplay is old. And as a design team that decided to go with turn-based combat, command-based combat with their game, like, what do you think turn-based combat and command-based combat kind of brings to you, the experience?
That comment is ridiculous, first of all.
Thank you.
I'm biased. I didn't know it was announced because I've been down with the flu, so if I did see it was announced, I probably would have thought it was just a weird dream. No, man, turn-based combat is here to stay like it just arrived. I mean, look at there's so many games right now, I think, that are hot with turn-based combat. It's really just a matter of some people would like the chance to think about what they're doing. You know, like it just focuses on a different set of skills. I have nothing against like the real-time stuff, but turn-based lets you, you know, solve a problem. I mean, chess hasn't gone away because it's a really solid, interesting, you know, problem to solve. And I think turn-based combat really is that, you know, XCOM, I've been playing Wargroove, which is basically, you know, Advanced Wars, but done really, really, well. I'm playing on the Switch. That's great. I mean, yeah, Darkest Dungeon, I would love to be held up in the group when people say, what are some really good turn-based combat games? But I don't think turn-based is a dated concept. I mean, people play board games, people play, you know, I think
declare that's things is dead. It's just like, yeah. Can't tripping over ourselves to tell everybody that things are dead. But it's hard, yeah, to like make a game where you're like, listen, your consequences are permanent, and if you screw this up, you're going to lose your character, and then turn around and make it like Twitch gameplay or something. So like for us, I think turn-based is a great way to do it. We were really cognizant though of cutting down on a lot of the downtime of turn-based combat. Like no combat system is perfect, but certainly one of the big problems I personally have with some turn-based games is just how long it takes to resolve the action. And so that was a big focus for us when we were sort of conceiving of our combat system. We always knew it would be turn-based. Like Tyler's got an incredible acumen for systems and a rich kind of rooting in board games. And so we always knew we wanted to do turn-based, but it was important for for us to find a way of doing it in a way that was punchy and actually felt good. Because I think that's what gets missed out a lot of the time in turn-based games, is you're still dealing with feelings. You still want the player to feel something when they click the button, even if it is issuing a command. And so we played a lot with, like, you know, the zoom in and the still frame poses, and tried to make it as visceral and intense as possible. And I think a big amount of credit goes to our audio team at Power Up, who did a great job of really selling all the attacks with these big booming sound effects. And so the result is, yes, it's turn-based, but it still feels good from a visceral standpoint to click those buttons. I think that's really important. So I agree. Turn-based isn't going anywhere, and there's a million ways you can do it. It's like saying the shooter is dead. Like, no, there's a million ways you can shoot stuff. We haven't even begun to unpack the ways in which people can be shot at.
Tell Square Enix that.
I think also it feels like turn-based kind of went away for a while, and then it's been roaring back. You know, we're in another heyday of it, and I don't know. I just think, like, you know, XCOM was a great reimagining of the old XCOM, and it spawned a whole bunch of games that look like it. We can't help but notice that there's a whole bunch of Darkest Dungeon looking games, you know, and we all build upon what was before. I mean, we've referenced some excellent old turn-based games, you know, that were influences for us. And I think it's a matter of what kind of problems do you want your player to solve? There's lots of reasons why you want there to be time pressure in some cases. But, you know, like Chris said it really well, in this case, we'd rather, I don't know, there's a lot of things you're going to curse at anyway if you lose a hero. We don't want one of them to be like, I was trying to click and I misclicked at the wrong spot, you know, when the timer was clicking down. Like, that's just not the experience we wanted you to have. We want you to be able to savor it. And, I don't know, you know, Chris is a wine drinker. It's like, not every drink you have is, you know, you shoot it back. Like, sometimes you want to savor it at your own pace. And I think that, you know, we want you to look at the things and think about, oh God, I want to do A or B. I don't know which one, you know, if I do A, this happens. If I do B, this happens. Oh, I got to go with B. You know, that's the mindset that we want.
But certainly, like, we would be remiss to retread exactly the same ground on a sequel. And we're keenly aware of that and factoring that into our design process. Like Tyler said, we've seen many games that extremely directly inspired very obviously from the way we structured our combat. And I think to do what we did again, literally, would be a mistake. So we're actively looking at ways to spice it up within the sort of framework that we built.
So ultimately, what are you most proud of from Darkest Dungeon, and how do you want to build on that for Darkest Dungeon 2?
I'm really proud to have authored this world made up of, like, all my favorite creative influences. I'm saying me and my, just because I'm only speaking for myself. I certainly am not the only person involved. But yeah, to have built, like, this world that kind of is compatible with the cosmic Lovecraft horror stuff, but isn't derivative or rooted in his exact fiction. The low fantasy mixed with the superhero DNA, like, just to be able to have crafted something out of all my favorite stuff and have people respond to it, I think I'm really proud of that. I'm really happy that the people could share what I find to be creatively cool and energizing, and that I was able to represent it in a way that people found attractive. That's just me talking about me. It's my favorite topic.
For me, I think it's being able to submit something to the RPG genre and have it stick. You know, I think just have played so many wonderful RPGs, and Chris and I talked early on, you know, before we broke ground on this, you know, and I think I remember saying, like, you know, or we both definitely agreed that we don't want to just, it's an evergreen genre, but we felt like we needed to do something different. You know, there has to be room to do something new within this amazing genre, or else we don't really want to do it, because we didn't feel our strength was going to be just kind of being state-of-the-art on all the current cool things. And we didn't have a big enough team. We didn't have funding. You know, all
these ray tracing.
Yeah. So we've got to do something new, you know, that is like different enough to make people want to buy it, even if it's not the, you know, the biggest budget game, the, you know, all these sorts of things. And so I think I'm just super proud that we were able to make an RPG that, you know, gets thrown around with some other, you know, incredible, inspiring RPG names. And that still is just kind of a cool shock. Every time I see the game referred to or inspires, you know, other games, it's just kind of a really surreal experience, having just grown up playing so many awesome awesome RPGs. So just being able to like find a little an unclaimed spot in that whole genre is kind of surprising and amazing at the same time.
Yeah, if you don't mind me praising you guys a little more, I remember the first time I saw Darkest Dungeon, because it kind of just exploded onto the screen for me. The art was so good and interesting and distinctive and very in my wheelhouse right from the start. And then as soon as I started playing it, I knew immediately that it was going to work, because the loop was basically perfect, of the short term of going into the dungeon, trying to survive it, how things could go horribly awry at any given moment. The party building in particular, which is always that is very squarely in my wheelhouse. And but then also just the horror aspects, the really horrifying enemies, especially the pig enemies. Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's and then things like getting around the campfire. And even though the characters didn't have a strong backstory per se or a strong narrative, you saw their personalities popping up all the time in just little conversations, either when they were dealing with craziness or when they were around the campfire. It was really well done.
Thanks, yeah. Thanks, man. We're
really cool.
Gonna try and beat it.
The target demographic. I mean, I think because you play a lot of, I imagine you're a tabletop gamer too,
mm-hmm.
and pen and paper and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, Darkest Dungeon is a love letter to a lot of those different things, like Chris said, crammed together with that very specific like theme and identity. And you know, we're lucky to have put together the right team to do it. And I think that's one of the exciting things moving forward. Like I kind of mentioned at the beginning about just kind of transitioning out of the survival into the, okay, well, this is a thing now. So now what do we do? It's been wonderful, and being able to grow the team and add and you know, it's a surreal but really cool experience to see things that are being created by the team that, you know, you don't, maybe you didn't exactly know that was happening, and then they ta-da, and they're like, whoa, that's amazing. You know, just as the team grows, you know, we can take a lot of pride in helping them create amazing stuff. So I don't know, we're super jazzed about the sequel, and that's the bottom line, is we wouldn't be working on it if we didn't feel like there's a lot more that we want to do in the Darkest Dungeon universe, both thematically, mechanically, all those things. And that was a threshold that had to get past for Chris and I to want to you know, choose that as the next project to work on, and it was a pretty easy decision, really.
All right, guys, thanks so much. I really look forward to seeing how Darkest Dungeon 2 translates to, I don't know, from going under the dungeons of the earth into, I don't know, mountains, snow? I'm curious to see how this all ends up.
We're enjoying the theory crafting.
Yeah, it's really cool to see. There was like a 20-minute video on YouTube unpacking the teaser and trying to figure out what we were going to do. So that's really cool.
Darkest Dungeon Skyrim edition?
Yeah, we got a lot of development ahead of us, but we have a really good team, and we're really excited by what we've got on the
burner. Hopefully we can expect early access this year.
It's been great talking to you.
All right, thanks, guys. And do you have anything else you want to promote before we let you go?
I don't know, maybe just a quick thanks to everybody who bought and played the game, or who went on Reddit and got mad at the game, or, you know, any of that stuff. It's all been really fantastic to see, and it actually does have like a profound effect on the team, like, because we all sort of stick our noses around the internet and we see what people are talking about and saying, and Even some random Reddit post saying like, hey, good job devs on turning this patch around to fix a bug or whatever. Like people, we see that, you know, it seems sometimes that the internet is like this other world, but no, we read that stuff and it matters. It means something to see that people respond to our efforts. So we really value our community and we want to, you know, honor them by making them suffer in new and exciting ways.
Oh, we do have a plug. Because we just got those copies. There's a collector's edition for Switch, a physical collector's edition for Switch, PS4, and Vita, believe it or not, because I don't know, all the Vita manufacturing has, you know, is ceasing or whatever, and we were able to get those in, and I think those are just about to hit stores or maybe are in stores now. They're made by Merge Games. They're the same people that did our physical editions last year, but these are like deluxe collector's editions. So I think those are probably just becoming available and they're limited quantities. They have some pretty cool inclusions in there. They did a great job. So check that out. Merge Games, you know, just look for the Darkest Dungeon collector's editions. Those are just hitting now.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. And I look forward to playing Darkest Dungeon 2.